Welcome back to this Claritas U course on the topic of abortion. I hope you've been enjoying the lessons so far, but today it's time for our expert interview, and I'm really excited about this one because not only do I get to join a good friend of mine, Trent Horn, but I get to share with you some of his tips and insights, which is great because I think he's the best Catholic defender of the pro-life position, and you're going to see why here in just a second. Trent is an author, a speaker, and a staff apologist for Catholic Answers. He earned a master's degree in theology from the Franciscan University of Steubenville, another master's degree in philosophy from Holy Apostles College, and he's pursuing a third master's degree in bioethics from the University of Mary. So he knows what he's talking about. Trent specializes in teaching Catholics to graciously and persuasively engage those who disagree with him. He models that approach on the weekly radio program Catholic Answers Live, where he regularly dialogues with atheists, pro-choicers, and other non-Catholic callers. If you have some time, go and listen to some of the episodes on Catholic Answers Live because it's a masterclass in how to interact and dialogue with skeptics. Trent is also an adjunct professor of apologetics at Holy Apostles College. And he's the author of 7 books at last count. Maybe Trent's written another one in the last week or so. But these include Answering Atheism, which you'll remember from our atheism course here at Claritas U, is my number one recommended book on atheism. Also, The Case for Catholicism, Why We're Catholic, and his newest book, which he co-wrote with Leila Miller, titled Made This Way, How to Prepare Kids to Face Today's Toughest Issues. Finally, I'm going to let Trent talk about this at the end of the interview, but he's the host of the Council of Trent podcast, which is just excellent. One of my favorite podcasts. I'm a subscriber. I'm also a patron, which means I donate money each month toward the podcast and receive bonus episodes and behind the scenes interviews and audiobook chapters and much, much more. So we'll talk about it at the end of the interview, but you can find it at councilofTrent.com. And that's council, like C-O-U-N-S-E-L. Nice little pun there. councilofTrent.com. So Trent, man, it's so good to be talking with you, especially about this topic. So welcome and thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here, Brandon. Always good to chat with you.
Let's start with a little bit of your background. How did you get involved with pro-life work, and why is abortion such a pressing issue for you?
Well, I got involved with pro-life work. It's kind of funny. I'd always been ambivalent about abortion, but never thought it was anything I was supposed to do anything about. It was not until my senior year of high school, actually it was my junior year of high school, I was a girl who went to a really tiny Catholic school. They only had like 20 students in this school. She asked me to be her date to their school's prom. So I think there were like 20 students. So if they all pick someone who doesn't go to the school, they can have a real prom, basically. And I went, and her dad was the president of the statewide Right to Life organization. So I became friends with him. He kind of mentored me, took me under the rope, you know, under his wing, showed me the ropes. And I learned about this issue and realized I felt compelled that I needed to do something because I also felt like I had a talent for speaking and articulating about this issue and also debating and dialoguing about this issue. And I noticed this especially when I was a student at Arizona State University. There was a pro-life organization called Justice for All that set up images of abortion on campus and dialogue with students about them. So I went and just kind of volunteered and helped as a student who was interested. Later, I saw, you know, I had a knack for debating the issue with other people, dialoguing, and so I followed them around the country, and then I ended up working for them full-time before I continued my pro-life work with Bishop Thomas Olmsted of the Diocese of Phoenix as the Respect Life Coordinator for that whole diocese, and then, of course, from there, going to Catholic Answers. And it's a pressing issue for me because, I mean, my family's been affected by this personally. 1 in 3 women has had an abortion, so most people are personally affected by abortion in some way. And just when you see what this issue is, that either pro-life advocates are, you know, turning women into second-class citizens, or pro-choice advocates are facilitating the state-sanctioned murder of unborn human beings, the stakes are so high. The one thing we can't do is just say, well, let's just agree to disagree. On air, people say to me, when they're exasperated, well, I think we just need to agree to disagree. I said, I don't agree to that because the stakes are too high. We got to figure out who's right and we have to do something about it.
I think I've heard you say in some of these radio dialogues when somebody says, let's just agree to disagree, you respond quite rightly. Would we say that about slavery or about torture or about any other major human rights issue?
Right. And the reason, especially as pro-life advocates, we can't agree to disagree because the other person is not asking for compromise. They're asking for surrender. Because the problem is, if you agree to disagree, well, let's just be neutral. Let's just not talk about this anymore. Then the side that defends the legal killing of unborn children wins because it's still legal. It still happens. There's no sense of, well, let's compromise and say, okay, we'll close half the abortion facilities in this country if you'll leave the other half alone. That's not the agreement. It's just, you guys shut up and we want to keep doing what we're doing. I'm sorry, but I'm not surrendering.
I mentioned at the outset that you've written 7 books. Is that accurate at last count, 7 books?
You know, Brandon, sometimes I lose track myself at this point. I think it's 7, yeah, although I'm finishing the 8th one up right now. So, yeah, it's 7th, the most recent one, yeah, being Made This Way with my co-author Layla Miller that, you know, we recently chatted about with Layla. That also covers abortion, actually, in that book. But, yeah, I think it's 7.
Okay, well, one of those books, I didn't mention it yet, I was saving it for right now, is a book on this issue. It's titled Persuasive Pro-Life. If you're watching the video, you'll see a picture of it here. Persuasive Pro-Life, How to Talk About Our Culture's Toughest Issue. And at the end of this Claritas U course, we'll have a book talk video where I recommend several of my favorite books on the abortion topic. And this is, sneak peek, number one. It's the one book I recommend to Catholics on how to talk about and defend the pro-life view. And in that book, Trent, you affirm something that we've discussed in this course, which is that the central question in the abortion debate is this: are the unborn human? Everything else hinges on that. And in this Claritas U course, we've learned how to make the case that they are, in fact, human. However, something that we didn't cover, and I was hoping to get your perspective on this, is many times you'll interact with pro-choice supporters who will admit that the unborn are human, but they say they're just biologically human and they're not yet persons. Therefore, they don't yet have rights. Talk to us a little bit about this distinction and how you'd respond to it.
Yeah, I think that it's a dubious distinction that is made. I mean, on the one hand, there is merit to it if you look strictly philosophically, that the terms human and person in the widest sense are not synonymous. Humans are a kind of person because there could be persons that are not human. There could be extraterrestrial life. In comics, you know, Superman is a person, but he's not human. He's Kryptonian. Even in the real world, despite what atheists will say, there are persons that are not human. Angels and demons are persons. They're unembodied persons without bodies, but they're not human. God is a trinity of persons. So the term there, person, of course, is used in an analogous way. But angels is a good example of that. Those are persons without bodies. They're not human. So a person is something that can be distinct from humans. But traditionally, among humans, human and person are synonymous. It's dubious that most people, when they try to craft the distinction between human and person here on Earth, they're doing so that they can disenfranchise or oppress or kill a particular group of humans. And so I like to ask people, look, are you comfortable making a similar kind of argument other people have made in the past in favor of oppression? Well, these Native Americans are human, but they're not persons. These Jews are human, but they're not persons. Your argument is similar to theirs. Does that concern you at all? And then when people say that, sometimes as pro-life advocates, we feel like we're on the defensive here and we have to prove the unborn are persons. What I recommend, actually, is when someone makes the claim, well, they're human, but they're not persons, force them to defend their claim. Ask them, well, what is a person? How do you know the unborn are not persons? Because, like, if I say to you, well, this table is not a rectangle, I have to know what a rectangle is. Let's say it's a circle. I know it's not a rectangle because a rectangle has 4 90-degree angles. I have to know that. If I say this table, going on with that, if it's a circle, if I say it's a unilateral shape, I don't know what I'm talking about. That's the same thing as a circle. So it's the same with the pro-choice advocate who says the unborn is not a person. They have to know what a person is to know a fetus or unborn child is not a person. So make them defend it and then point out where their definition is either inconsistent, it excludes born human beings, includes non-human animals, or is just ad hoc and designed to exclude unborn children.
And I've had this conversation with pro-choice opponents, and I've asked them to define person, and they sort of waffled on that. But then I specifically say, okay, well, then when does the unborn biological human become a person? At what point? And
right.
At this point, they'll usually say, well, either they'll point to some arbitrary moment of development, or they'll just say, well, I don't know. And that's when I like to, you know, thrust the dagger forward and say, well, if we don't know, that's an argument against abortion, because we wouldn't abort someone that might be a person but might not. We would have to know with certainty that they're not a human person.
Right. And I think that's a good argument to put forward, the argument from uncertainty, to say that, look, even if you're not sure, shouldn't you give a benefit in favor of the side of life? Now, I don't think it's a lockdown argument. It's more of an argument to tip the scale towards our side for someone who's ambivalent. I prefer a stronger demonstration. Because then I might say, well, look, if we don't know when a fetus becomes a person, how can we ever try anyone for murder? If we kill, you know, a 35-year-old, might say, well, how do we know that that's a person? We don't know when fetuses become persons. Is it at birth? Is it a year after? Is it 30 years after? And then people will say, well, it's obviously a person. Ah, now you're a lot more confident. How do you know that, though? How do you know? Well, because they can talk, they can think. What about people who can't talk and think? And so me, I like to take it back to infanticide. The only two consistent positions on this issue, well, actually, this is a story Peter Kraif likes to tell, that he once talked to a group of feminists and said that their positions on abortion entailed infanticide. And they said, Professor Kraif, you're absolutely right. And he says, oh, so you're pro-life now. They say, no, we're pro-infanticide. So, you know, they're the only two consistent positions to say either a person is a member of a rational kind or a member of the humankind, which would include the unborn, or a person is someone who has rational abilities, which would exclude infants. And Peter Singer, Michael Tooley, other philosophers have said, yeah, the pro-choice argument naturally leads to infanticide, just most people don't want to accept that.
Well, let's unpack that just a little bit more. This wasn't one of the questions I was planning to ask you, but in your book, Persuasive Pro-Life, you have an appendix on answering the infanticide, I don't know if I would call it an argument, but the conclusion. What do you do when you're talking with somebody and you're trying to do this reductio ad absurdum to make them agree that their position embraces
First, I gotta say, it's very sad if I have to write a book and I have to include an appendix, how to answer infanticide. I feel like if I wrote a book on sexual morality, appendix, what to do when they say rape is okay. It's a sad state of affairs when you have to include something like that in a book. In fact, there was a symposium, I think it was a First Things symposium or it was a journal collection on the question of infanticide, because in 2014, there was an article in the Oxford Medical Journal by Minerva and Giublini, and they were rehashing the old Singer arguments. And the article was called Afterbirth Abortion, Why Not Let the Baby Die? You know, and it's more of a shock piece. It's the same argument. It's been around forever. And so they put out this argument, and there was a symposium in First Things, and Robert George did a reply to it. And George's reply was just, I don't have to make an argument. I just know this is wrong, so suck it. You know? I mean, he just appealed to our moral intuitions are just obvious on this one. So, I don't have to defend it, just like I don't have to defend that the external world is real. You know? And I give George a little bit of kudos for his gumption on that. Now, there's other people. Christopher Cazor, in his book, The Ethics of Abortion, has a chapter critiquing Singer and Tooley. And he says, well, you know, moral intuition, yeah, but 2,000 years ago, infanticide was an accepted intuition. So we might need a little bit more. And there's different ways you can go about it. One, I think, though, appealing to intuitions to show that if someone, that is one thing, one path you can argue, to say, look, if you're wrong about that, how do you know any of your other moral intuitions are correct? I think people are, that the wrongness of infanticide is probably on par with the wrongness of rape or the wrongness of genocide. But if we're wrong about infanticide, we could just be wrong about everything. We can't have any moral intuitions. So the person may not be comfortable with all their moral beliefs in peril at that point, that they, they've given up too much to defend their position. The second is to make an argument to say that the point about infanticide and Singer arguments is they say, well, you know, species membership is not morally relevant. It doesn't matter. It just matters if you can feel pain. Species membership is not relevant. But you can use arguments to show, well, no, species membership is valuable. Like, imagine I had a injection that could give the being who receives it the ability to read. And I could give it to a 10-year-old boy or a cat. Who should I give it to? Well, it seems to me like you should give it to the 10-year-old boy because while both beings can't read, one of them is harmed by that. One of them, by their nature, should be able to. And yet, well, why do we think that? Because they're human. That's just part of their rational nature. And so that implies their nature is different than other beings, and so they're accorded different rights. You could also make arguments, the Singer arguments are interesting. They say, well, you know, as long as you're not rational, you're not a person, it's not wrong to kill you. One argument I like is, what if we took a fetus and we genetically engineered it so that it grew up to be an unconscious organ donor, or grew up to be a slave who loves being enslaved, so slavery doesn't harm this person? Most people would say it's wrong to engineer a fetus to grow up to be a slave who loves being enslaved. Why? Well, because they deserve to grow up and develop in a normal kind of way for their kind of being. Ah, if that's the case, if they have the right to develop normally, that means they have the right to develop at all. Hence, that would cut against abortion and infanticide. So yeah, not something you come up with a lot, but I think it's important to deal with academics like Singer and others to show, no, we have rational arguments that do not rely just merely on moral intuition or gut reaction alone.
Okay, here's another objection that I've heard often, and it's not one that we cover here in the Claritas U course. It goes like this. Twinning shows that life does not begin at conception, so pro-life people are wrong on that point. I've heard this more on the internet than among actual conversations with real people, but can you explain how twinning works and then how you'd respond to that objection?
Yeah, during the embryo's development, prior to the development of what's called the primitive streak, the cell body is able to separate into two separate bodies, and those two cellular bodies can continue to grow and develop into complete, fully developed human beings. This occurs in the first 2 weeks of development. So one, as a practical element, it don't matter. When it comes to abortion, it doesn't matter. All abortions happen after that point. So it has nothing to do with the morality of abortion. It comes up more with things like embryo research and embryo destruction. Like, well, we can destroy them before they're not a person here. But my argument is, there's several things I would retort with. One, how does the fact that the embryo can twin show that it's not a person? We don't know exactly what happens with twinning, but we shouldn't conclude it's not a person. It could be the case you have one person who then in the twinning process, another person comes into existence. So you have Bob the embryo. At day 10, twinning occurs. So now you have Bob and you have Tommy. And Bob continues to exist. That doesn't prove the fact that that Tommy came from Bob doesn't mean that Bob never existed in the first place. Ramesh Ponnuru wrote a book on pro-life and cultural pro-life issues several years ago. And he said of this objection that, look, if the ability to make a twin from my body means I'm not a person, that means you and I aren't persons. Because you could take a skin cell, take the DNA out, put it in a denucleated ovum, and make another embryo. Does that mean I'm not a person because you could make a twin from me? No. But it also could be the case that Bob, upon twinning, dies, and then Tom and Frank come into existence. We don't know exactly what happens. But Patrick Lee gives this good example, the flatworm. You take a flatworm, you bisect it, you have two flatworms now that will grow and develop. Would you say, oh, there was no worm before that point? Well, what's writhing around in your hand? So ultimately, I think the twinning objection doesn't succeed to show the unborn is not a distinct human organism on a path of development. It just may have the capacity to develop into more than one organism.
You mentioned earlier in our interview that studies estimate that about one third of adult women will have had an abortion at some point, I think before they turn the age 45. So what this means is that for many of us, this isn't just an abstract, contentious moral issue. This is a personal issue. The chances are extremely high that someone among our friends, our family, our coworkers has had an abortion. So what advice would you give people when they're discussing abortion with somebody who's actually had one?
I think what's important here is to remember what St. Paul said in Ephesians 4:15, to speak the truth in love, that we shouldn't appeal simply to worry about another person's feelings, but we also shouldn't use a lot of harsh condemnation. I think we could say things like, you know, I know everyone who experiences an abortion or chooses it does so for different reasons and has different reactions. And so I want to hear you out as to your reasons and your reactions. If you're willing to hear me out to see, here's just what I feel about abortion itself, that I care, and you can ground this in a wider set to say, I am opposed to abortion because I am opposed to anything that harms the dignity of the human person. So I believe abortion harms a child's dignity because it ends their life, but I also believe it harms a woman's dignity because it makes her an accomplice to that end, because it attacks her at what makes her very special and unique, her ability to gestate human life. And so it's an affront on her dignity as well. So to show that you care about the welfare and dignity of all people involved in this issue, and you seek their well-being, and that for people who have had abortions, to say that, you know, there's physical harms, but there's also spiritual harms. And that I would hate for someone to feel that they're forever separated from God. A lot of post-abortive women treat abortion like the unforgivable sin. Tell them, no, it's not. And a good passage to read to them is paragraph 99 from the Gospel of Life, where Pope St. John Paul II has a special message for women who are post-abortive. And it's a very encouraging one that I would recommend for your listeners. Just go to Gospel of Life, section 99 at the end of the encyclical. That's something I think would be helpful to share with someone who's post-abortive.
Okay, let's shift gears here. What would you say is the biggest mistake that pro-life supporters make when discussing abortion, and how do we avoid it?
The biggest mistake, to piggyback what you talked about earlier in the show, is not talking about the issue, what are the unborn? Absolute biggest mistake. We treat abortion like it's some kind of social problem. And people blame us. They say, well, how many children are you going to adopt? And you only care about life before birth. What about welfare? What about helping the poor? You know, and then we get all caught up. I could adopt, or we can help the poor. Or I don't believe in these kind of welfare programs. And we argue about it as a political issue instead of just saying, look, what are these beings? If they're not human, who cares? If they are human, how can we justify this? Pro-lifers always make mistakes when they try to justify abortion when they try to argue against abortion on other grounds without just sticking to, look, what are the unborn, and not holding the pro-choice advocates' burden of proof over them to say, show me they're not human. Show me these aren't human beings. So always stay focused like a laser on the question, what are the unborn? As a tactical approach, I recommend asking questions more than making statements. That when you ask someone, well, what are the unborn? What does it mean to be pregnant? When does life begin? How do you know that that's true? How do you know the unborn's not a person? You make them defend their position and see that it's incoherent. And so I think that's an important way to make sure that they have to confront the issue and grapple with it for themselves without you just kind of lecturing them.
Excellent. Super helpful. Now, you've talked with probably thousands of pro-choice supporters over the years on college campuses, on the radio, on the internet, elsewhere. In your experience, what would you say is the strongest argument for abortion that you've heard, and how would you answer it?
I think the strongest argument is probably the bodily rights argument, especially in the case of rape. This is the argument that says, look, I know the unborn's a human being, but I can't be forced to give my body to support another person. It's strong because it admits the unborn's human, doesn't deny what's obvious. And we do have this kind of sentiment that, yeah, even if, you know, you needed my kidneys, you couldn't force me to give you a kidney to keep you alive. So, so it likens it to intuitions we have normally about organ donation. But to respond to it, we should point out the differences, the disanalogies, and say, no, abortion is not like refusing to give someone a kidney. Like, if you're dying, Brandon, you need my kidney, and I don't give it to you, I don't kill you. I failed to save your life. I failed to do something heroic. Abortion is not like refusing to give a dying person a kidney. It's more like if I gave you a kidney and then ripped it out of your body again and killed you in the process. Because in abortion, you don't have someone who's dying that you failed to save. You have someone who's healthy, who's your child, that you have caused to be in this dependent condition, and then you decide to initiate what the philosopher Philippa Foot calls the fatal sequence of events. So in the organ donation case, the fatal sequence was initiated when your kidneys got sick or your bone marrow, whatever. I don't initiate it. I just failed to intervene. With abortion, the child's just fine. It's the abortion procedure that initiates the fatal sequence of events that brings about the child's end. And so this is not a case of refusing to help. It's intervening and actively killing. And someone who's your own child that you have special duty towards that are not like my kidneys. And even in the case of rape, where it's not a case of responsibility, it's still a case of a parent providing ordinary means of care to a child. So, yeah, if a mom was shipwrecked on an island with her child, she wouldn't necessarily be called to fillet her skin. That would be extraordinary and heroic. But she might be called to breastfeed an infant. That's a natural use of her organs to keep the child alive. Much the same way that an unborn child has a natural right to the things his mother can naturally produce through pregnancy to keep him alive. And so it's very different from organ donation, which is the extraordinary giving of organs versus the ordinary use of the body in pregnancy.
Super good, super good. Well, let's close with this. What's one tip, one takeaway that you would want all Catholics to know when it comes to discussing abortion?
I think this would be my tip. The facts speak loudly so you don't have to. The facts speak loudly so you don't have to. It's okay to be emotional about this issue. I get emotional about abortion. If you're not emotional, you need to get a reality check. It's just not okay to let our emotions control us and, you know, be the dogs on the leash pulling us down the sidewalk. We have to be in control of them. So they can motivate us to be assertive in conversations, but we don't want to come off as like hysterical or shrill. Instead, by harnessing them and asking tough questions, we don't have to shout, yell, or be accusatory or defamatory. We can just ask pointed questions to get the other person to see what a moral atrocity this is. And always remember, we don't have to up our emotions. When we present the facts in this way, they speak loudly. We don't have to. And by asking questions, we don't have to come off as preachy. We make the other person grapple with the issue.
Well, I want to thank Trent for joining us here. And one more time, I want to mention his fantastic book. It's called Persuasive Pro-Life, How to Talk About Our Culture's Toughest Issue. If you're a VIP here at Claritas U, this book is already on its way to you. If not, go to Catholic Answers and pick up a copy of the book today. It is the number one Catholic book on discussing pro-life topics, especially when it comes to abortion. Trent, before we go here, I promise I'd let you tell us a little bit more about your podcast. Tell us about the Council of Trent.
Yeah, so the Council of Trent, C-O-U-N-S-E-L, is a daily podcast I do produced by Catholic Answers where I explain and defend the faith. I go deeper into topics. I just recently did an episode about the missionary who was killed on North Sentinel Island and answering critics who say we should not evangelize lost tribes. So the goal of the Council of Trent is a daily half-hour podcast to equip you to explain and defend your faith. And on Fridays, we have fun, just free-for-all Fridays. Get to, you know, relax at the end of the week. I talk about all kinds of random things I'm interested in, comic books, money-saving tips, disaster history, and people find it to be interesting stuff to further edify you. But the majority of the week is half-hour helpful sessions where you learn better how to go deeper into your faith and how to explain it and defend it. And if you want to learn more about that, if you want to listen to it, you can get it at Google Play or iTunes, Council of Trent, C-O-U-N-S-E-L. You can also see it at TrentHornPodcast.com. Probably the easiest website is TrentHornPodcast.com. If you become a subscriber, you make a donation, it keeps the podcast going, and you get access to bonus content, including a nifty little t-shirt with my animated mug on it. So definitely check that out at TrentHornPodcast.com.
Yeah, and I'd encourage all listeners here, definitely, if nothing else, subscribe to the free podcast, but also consider becoming a patron. I'm a patron. You pay $5 a month, $10 a month, however much you can afford to donate to Trent's ministry, and you get all sorts of really cool bonuses. So join me in becoming a patron of the Council of Trent. Well, Trent, thanks so much for joining us, and thank you to everyone watching this, and we'll see you in the next lesson here at Claritas U.